following Jesus is hard work. And it's always a good thing to be with people who are working just as hard, or at least trying to work as hard as you are, to follow Jesus. Because then you don't feel like you're so much by yourself in what you're doing. Right on? And my hope this morning is that the reflections that I have to share will be ones that will encourage us to be more able to follow Jesus. Because in the end, that's really what this is all about. I mean, neuroscience is really fun, and it's fascinating and exciting. Well, for some of us, it is. And it's a beautiful part of the world that God has created. But in the end, it's part of the world that God has created as he tells a bigger story. Like, the story of the world is not about interpersonal neurobiology. The story of the world is about how God is creating a place of goodness and beauty and mercy. And the question that I'm always wrestling with every day when I get up is, how can I be part of that? And in what ways am I going to screw up that process today? Because as I tell folks, before I'm a psychiatrist, I'm a professional sinner. I figure that anybody can call themselves a professional that they do a lot of and that they're really good at. I've been practicing it since I was like 2 days old, I suppose. And so our time together today is not just about learning new information. Our time today begins, first of all, I want to invite us to think about this motif. The first bullet that I have on the little handout that you have there is the bullet of what it means to live in a time of exile. And if any of you are familiar with a group called the Trinity Forum, Thursday night they had an evening conversation which Mark Laberton spoke. He's the president of Fuller Theological Seminary. And he spoke about this idea that we are now, as believers, especially in the West, we are at a time when we are in a space that we would call in exile, that we aren't the dominant culture of the West. What does it mean for us then to be as Daniel was, to be as the Israelites were in Egypt, to be as the Christians were in the diaspora? What does it mean for us to live in the world and to speak to the world out of a place of salt and light, beauty and goodness? Eugene Peterson and Dallas Willard were once at a conference, and at the end of the conference, during the Q&A session, they were speaking together, and the question was asked, if you were to describe the one metaphor that really accurately portrays the history of what it means to be the people of God over the course of our time in the world, what would it be? And they thought for a moment and said, we really think that that motif would be that of the wilderness or that of being in exile. That this is not our last home. Now, I don't mean by that that we're going someplace off into the ether, but I mean that there is a kingdom that is coming that is different than the one in which we live. And so my hope this morning is for us to explore a little bit more about what this particular element is that God is revealing to us, I would suggest, that enables us to live more like Jesus and so reflect God's kingdom in the particular realms of life that you occupy. So we're just going to go straight through this. I'm going to speak for probably about 30 minutes, and that give us some time for Q&A if you want to do that. That'd be a good idea? Okay. So there are a number of different points that I try to talk about in this book, Anatomy of the Soul, and they go something like this. The first is that if we were to be honest, we would say that there really is a hunger and a thirst, no matter who we are, whether we're believers or not. There is a hunger for a world of goodness and beauty. I've used that phrase now a couple of times. There is a hunger for a world of goodness and beauty. And I don't just mean that in the abstract. Like we'd say, oh, yes, I'd like a world of goodness and beauty, please. I'd like and fries to go with that, please. No, what we're at, like, we want this, for instance, in our families. And there are people in this room right now for whom the words goodness and beauty would be hard-pressed to be found in our family. We want this in our educational institutions. We want this in our places of employment. We want this in our politics. We want this in our world. And when I say that, again, we don't just mean it in the abstract. We mean it in like real boots-on-the-ground operations. Agreed? Point number two. The emerging data in fields of neuroscience and attachment, this field that we call interpersonal neurobiology, the emerging data actually offer insights that point to that very world of goodness and beauty. If we pay attention to the data and do what the data suggests and invites us to do, we find that it points us to that world of goodness and beauty. Number three, that very data, in addition to pointing us to that world that we long for, that very data also both reflects and energizes the story of the gospel. So in Paul's letter to the Romans, when he says in the first chapter of the 20th verse, from the beginning of time, from the foundation of the world, if we look at creation, creation points us to God's nature and his power. If we look at creation, creation points us in that direction. Now, creation doesn't equal that, but creation points us in that direction. And so we see that when we pay attention to how the brain works optimally, how relations optimally work, it points us to the very story that we read about from Genesis to Revelation. That's number three. Number four. One of the primary features of this whole enterprise of interpersonal neurobiology, I would suggest, is the feature of what we call being known. What does it mean to be known? So, for instance, we live in a world where knowing things is a really big deal, right? I mean, this is National Presbyterian Church. This is like a power community, right? I mean, like people who, like, and it was because knowing things means power. Now, I don't mean that in a bad way, but I mean, like, we know things in order to have agency in our world, right? We know things about computer science. We know things about physics. We know things about, you know, what the rules of the road are when the light turns green to yellow to red. We want to know things in order for us to navigate our universe. We want our children to know things so that they can know more things, so that they can know more things, so that they can then grow up and go to college and have kids who do the same thing, right? We want to know things. And again, this is not a disparagement. Like, it's important that we know things because I need to know that I'm going to give the child this medicine and not this medicine so that I help them and not kill them, right? I want to know that. I might kill my child for other reasons, but that's a whole other kettle of fish. But let me ask you this question. Could you name me three people? If I were to ask you, we're going to take a poll. Could you name three people who, if I were to ask them, they could tell me collectively, between the three of them, they could tell me everything there is to know about you? I mean everything. They'll tell me your worst fear. They'll tell me your deepest shame. They'll tell me the last time you looked at pornography. They'll tell me the last time you gossiped about somebody. They'll tell me, they can tell me everything. Leslie Newbegin likes to write about the fact that we live in a world in which we've come to believe that there is really only primarily one way of knowing things. And that's the scientific way of knowing things. We, human beings, are the observers, and we decide what the questions are, right? And we ask these questions in research settings. So we decide what the questions are, which means we also decide what the possible answers could be, because those answers can only be determined based on the questions that we ask. If I don't ask certain questions, certain answers won't even be optional to me. Does that make sense? But what about this? What if somebody starts to ask you questions? What if we're not the people who are asking questions? like my friend Steve. Steve came to me as a mid-50-year-old gentleman because he was depressed. And Steve was, Steve kind of had the world by the tail in many respects. I mean, he was a scientist. But he'd come to me not because I was a Christian, because Steve most certainly was not. In fact, he was emphatic that he was not. He came to me because 6 months prior to coming to see me, his son had hanged himself. And Steve wanted answers, and he couldn't get them. Now, I don't know, I mean, if you just looked at the numbers of people who are in the room, the likelihood that suicide has touched somebody in this room is actually pretty high in some way, shape, or form. It's either happened in our family, or it's happened to someone that we know that we're close to. We've heard about it. And Steve's story was significant because this is a guy who was coming to me because he was depressed, and he thought, I mean, he had a friend who had known me and thought that I could be helpful, but mostly because, look, I'm depressed, and I'm a scientist, and I know that if you're depressed, you get antidepressants. And certainly we went down that road, but that wasn't the only set of questions that we asked. We didn't just ask questions about what he was feeling and whether or not he was sleeping and whether or not he could concentrate and so forth, all of which he couldn't do very well, which didn't help him do his job. But we asked other questions. We asked other questions about what it was like for him to grow up and what it was like for him to be married, what it was like for him to have lost his son and so forth and so on. And you see, there are lots of things that we don't know that we don't know about ourselves, that we are only going to know unless somebody, when someone else asks us the question. That is what it means for us to be known by someone else. For someone else to do the question asking and to reveal things to ourselves about ourselves that we can only know when someone else is in the room with us. Does that make sense? Here's the thing. It struck me as really, like it just kind of jumped off the page. When St. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 8, verses 2 and 3, he says, like, the person who loves God is known by God. He doesn't say the person who loves God knows God. He doesn't say the person who loves God does all these things. The person who loves God is known by God. To what degree this morning are any or all of us known by God? And we can say that can be directly measured by the degree to which we are known by anybody else. Because for good or for ill, God, as it turns out, has to deal with the same brain that everybody else does with you and with me. Which means the degree to, like, it's not hard for me to say, oh, like, I don't trust people, but I really trust God. It's the people that, you know, the world would be fine if there just weren't any people on it. But as it turns out, I can imagine things in my head about what I believe God knows about me, but it's very different for me to think that God knows facts and figures and all my vital statistics. It's a completely different story to contend with the question of, to what degree am I actually known by God? To what degree do I experience being known by God? To what degree is it like for me? What is it like for me to have someone else ask me the questions and me have to look them in the eye and provide the answers for them? And what if I don't know those answers? Steve didn't have answers for everything. So we started to talk, because he's a scientist, we started to talk a little bit about anatomy of the soul. And I suggested to him that, as it turns out, in bullet number 5, like that this is not just going to be about your personal growth. You see, because the work that we do in the heart extends into everything else that we do. Everyone here has a particular vocational domain, and actually you've got multiple vocational domains. We are mothers and fathers, and we're scientists, and we're teachers, and we're carpenters, and we're parents, and we're sons and daughters. We're all these different vocational things. And there is not a domain that we occupy that is not touched by the question of to what degree am I known? There's not a domain that's not touched by that. Because if it's true that in the end, life on this earth boils down to relationships, That means that relationships and what I do with them is going to touch everything else that I do. It's going to touch the degree to which I can be creative about things. So if I'm a computer scientist and I'm designing software programming, one might think, what does relationship have to do with what I'm doing with the computer? It has everything to do with what I do with the computer. Because the degree to which I can be creative with that computer has everything to do with how secure I am in my person in general. It doesn't mean that I can't be creative if all my relationships are screwed up. But if my relationships are screwed up, it means that there will be a certain amount of psychic energy that necessarily is being dedicated to just managing all that stuff that will not therefore be available to me to do the work that I so long to do. Steve and I started to talk about this idea of interpersonal neurobiology and what it was, because as a scientist, he was interested in knowing what does my brain and relationships have to do with this thing called depression, and what can it do to speak to the fact that I've lost my son. With interpersonal neurobiology, what we mean by this is that there are a number of different research interests in the world that like to talk about the brain, right? So there are neuroscientists that study rats, for example. Right? If you're like a psychiatrist or psychologist, you can't give a talk and not like mention rats at least once. So there, I've mentioned them, right? So there we go. For all the folks that need to hear that, there we mentioned them. So we do rat studies, and we do studies in child psychiatry. Sometimes they don't feel very different. We do family therapy study. We do a range of different things. And as it turns out, there are a lot of different areas of study that study things about the mind, but that don't talk very much or very easily to each other. And so my friend and colleague, Dan Siegel, about 10 or 11 years ago, came out with a book called The Developing Mind, in which he first put forward this idea of what we're calling interpersonal neurobiology. And it is kind of what it sounds like. It is a field in which we're really studying the intersection of all those things that have to do with the way the brain and relationships shape one another and their intersections. Steve thought this was interesting stuff because, as a scientist, he figured, well, now we're kind of like moving out of the ethereal, like, mumbo-jumbo of psychoanalysis, whatever that is, and we're going to ground this in things like neurons. So that is the field of interpersonal neurobiology. But one of the things that it also seeks to do is before we're going to do anything else, we have to say, what is this thing that we're dealing with that we call the mind? I mean, this is one of the major issues that interpersonal neurobiology tries to address. And Steve's mind was broken. And here's the thing. We don't have to have had a child hang themselves for our minds to be broken. You see, what's interesting about the biblical narrative, would suggest that everybody's mind is broken. We're all screwed up. Like the question, like as we say in the business, right, there are only two kinds of people in the world. There are people who are broken and who know it, and people who are broken and who don't know it. And everything that we then do in response to that reality is not just about our response to our brokenness. It's as our response to whether we know it or not. Many of us in this room have places that were broken, and we know it. But it's also just as well the case that there are places in our hearts that are broken that we don't want to know about. Because to do so would frankly be way too overwhelming. And this is where psychiatrists start to make life a little miserable for us, right? Because we start to ask questions about things. And I ask questions of Steve about his life. And as it turns out, Steve had a very interesting life. He actually grew up in a home where his parents were believers. And by the time he was in high school, knew that he wanted to be in science. But this is one of these predictable stories where his parents gave him not just not much encouragement, but also rather somewhat discouraged him from entering into this field because they didn't think that this was very interesting from a Christian perspective. And so it wasn't long, not just by the time he went to college, he wasn't just done with his family, he was done with faith. Because he was a smart guy, and he wasn't running into a lot of smart Christians. All the people he was running into had really no answers for him about evolution and this and that, so forth and so on. And by the time he was in graduate school, he had all kinds of reasons for why he didn't just want to leave the faith, but why faith was actually pretty bad for people. And then he gets married and he has kids. And his marriage was fairly healthy and his kids were doing okay, at least so he thought. And of course, Steve was doing all the right things, getting his kids educated, making sure that he had the right job, all that. And so what do you do when your son hangs himself? So one of the first things when we started to explore this question about Steve's mind being broken, one of the first things we had to do is ask the question, well, what is the mind? If it's broken, how do we know what it is in order if we're going to try to like do anything to fix it? And so in the field of interpersonal neurobiology, we have a working definition of the mind that I have printed there for you so that you don't have to like write it out. So here we go. The mind is a process that's an emerging process, right, that is both embodied and relational. It emerges between and within and between brains whose task it is to regulate the flow of energy and information. Now, if you had to write, you can all say that to me back. You just say that to me without reading off your paper, right? So we're just going to walk through this real quickly. So the mind, first of all, is a process. It's moving, right? Your mind is never actually still. Just like your brain activity is never actually still. Your mind is constantly moving. It's a moving process. Interestingly enough, not unlike the God we say that we serve. We serve a God who's moving. Now, his pace changes. But he's never just not doing anything. Jesus said, I do what I see my Father doing. I'm doing what my Father's at work doing. This is what I do. God is at work all the time, changing his pace. But he's never not moving. We serve a God of movement, and he's made a mind that is also moving, right? It's a process that is both embodied and relational. And by embodied, we mean that your mind is not limited to your brain. How many, if you're anxious, how do you know you're anxious? Don't be shy. Well, how do you know you're anxious? Palms, heart rate, so forth and so on. All of which are connected to your brain, but they're not your brain. If you were to get rid of your body, well, that would be an interesting, just to sit to like a bunch of heads sitting on chairs, right? That would be weird. But if you were to get rid of your body, there would be a lot that we just wouldn't sense or feel. If we were to stop your body's capacity to send messages to your brain couldn't tell us very much. So we're not just embrained. Our mind is not just embrained. Our mind is embodied, which is really interesting, right? When you read 1 Corinthians 6:19, when St. Paul says, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? You were bought with a price. He doesn't say, don't you know that your mind is a temple, your brain is a temple of the Holy Spirit, your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. And so one of the questions that we ask is, well, are we paying attention to our bodies well enough to know what God is trying to tell us from various different places that he occupies, as it turns out? It's embodied, the mind is, but it's also relational. Nobody in this room gets to where we are without the help of other people. Our brain must have interaction with other human relationships in order for the neural networks within the brain to actively do what they need to do to mature. And if I don't have those relationships, my brain will not mature in a way that allows me to be flexible, adaptive, energized, and so forth when it comes to interpersonal relationships as I grow into an adult. My mind needs relationships. And isn't that interesting? Let us make mankind in our image. Genesis 1:26. Notice that, first of all, it's the only time in that whole creation narrative where God actually has a conversation before he does something, right? And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be this. And God said, let there be the North Carolina Tar Heels, and there were the Tar Heels. I mean, all these things that God just says, thanks be to God, right? All that he just says, right? And then there was the other ones, the Duke Blue Devil. Okay, all right, sorry. Digress. But when it comes to mankind, he pauses, right? He has a conversation. Let us, he doesn't just say, let there be mankind, right? Let us make mankind. Like he's, it's like he's thinking about it, but he's thinking about it with let us make mankind in our image. That in order for us to live, it requires that I recognize that I am not me. I am only who I am because I'm in relationship with you. Take you out of the picture, I stop having the same kind of meaning that I do. But we live in a culture that is committed to convincing us that we are masters of the universe by ourselves as individuals. It's a problem. And when we try to live the way our culture wants us to live in that way, it creates great distress in the brain. It creates anxiety states. And as we say, depression is really what happens when people run out of their capacity to take care of what makes them anxious. Of course, I have to admit, this is good for business for me. Especially living in Washington, right? I'll never be out of a job. Right? Because, you know, there's always election years, right? People are, like, anxious beforehand and depressed afterwards. We're like, either way, I win. Let us make mankind. And it's almost as if God's like, do we want to do this? Because, like, this is what he gets when he does. Right? He gets me. He gets us with our broken brains. We call it sin in the biblical narrative. This is what we get. Relationships shape the brain as much as the brain shapes relationships. That's part of the mind, that it emerges within and between brains. So it's an emerging process. It's not just something that, like, you get when you're born, right? It continues to emerge and grow and become something more and more and more of that. Whose task it is to regulate the flow of energy and information. What is that? Well, by energy, we simply mean like all of that neural stuff, all that electrochemical stuff that happens between your ears, like all those neurons that fire. That's energy. But all that energy represents information. So, for instance, when you have a thought about something, when you have an image in your mind, when you have a gut feeling, all of that is represented by some kind of neural activity in the brain. But it has meaning to it. In this sense, we're not just bodies, and we're not just souls. We are, as the text in Genesis also says in 2:7, and God formed mankind from the dust of the earth. He breathed into man's nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. We are dirt and we are breath. And take either one of those away, and we don't amount to much. Now, we talked about this with Steve, and as Steve started to listen to this, we also asked him other questions. Questions about what does it mean for his story to begin to shape all these things about the mind? Because here's one interesting thing, too. About what it means for us to live relationally and live in embodied, live people who are really wanting to grow our minds, it means that we have to pay attention to the story that we're living in and the story that we believe we've come from. The story that we're living in and the story that we believe we've come from. And here's how we do this. We talk then about this word called integration. The mind has lots of different working parts to it. We have things like attention, we have memory, we have sensations, we have images, we have a whole range of different things that make up the mind's activity and that are correlated with different parts of the brain's work. For those to work well together, they need to be integrated, and by integrated, this is what I mean. In our particular language, we mean the following. If you were to run a company, you'd say that that company has different divisions, and each of those divisions would need to be well capitalized. And so we'd want each one, sales, marketing, and so forth, to do their work really, really well. But if they were only capitalized but not talking to the other divisions in the company wouldn't do very well. We need this company both to be well capitalized but also to be talking to one another. So for a system to be differentiated means it's like having the best sales group that we can get. They're going to differentiate. They're going to do the best they can. So for instance, Steve wasn't really one that paid a lot of attention to the notion of emotion. Anybody here like emotion? Anybody here dislike emotion? Emotion happens all the time. We say that emotion, for instance, is like the fuel in the tank of the car. If you take emotion out of the human equation, it stops running. And emotion is everything. It's happening all the time. Okay, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand here, but how many between the time you woke up this morning and the time you got to church had a disagreement or a fight with somebody? I tell folks, I think that we should have like a little confession booth. It's like a drive-through confession booth right at the church entrance. So like you can get into church and be like, fine, because like all you know what happens in the car on the way to church. You stop at the booth, you confess, and then you can go in and feel better. That's emotion at work. Steve didn't really have much to do with that because he'd come from a family where we didn't pay much attention to emotion. And because we don't pay much attention to that, it means there's going to be a lot about what's going on in my mind that is happening that I don't know that I don't know. And the thing was that because he didn't pay much attention to emotion, he wasn't really able to sense or pay attention to the emotional drift that started to take place in his son when it happened. So no wonder Steve could say that he was shocked. He didn't see it coming. He had no idea. I thought my son was fine. But as it turns out, as we talked about Steve's story in his own life, he was able, using his scientific mind, he was able to go back and peer into things and see that his family was not one that asked much about emotion either. They were more interested in making sure that things were right than they were more interested in things being connected and loved. That's an example of what we mean, of one of those elements of the mind that needs to be both developed but also connected, integrated together. And we see this expressed in the 86th Psalm, Lord, create in me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. An undivided, not a heart that is disconnected, disintegrated, but a heart that is whole, brought together. Create for me this heart. We notice that when that happens, in the process of doing this, we depend upon a thing called neuroplasticity. In order for us to have integrated minds, we have to get the brain to do things that it otherwise hasn't been able to do so far. In the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a great explosion of research in this area and understanding of neuroplasticity, the capacity for the brain to make changes neurologically that we thought before that it couldn't change. And in fact, we read in Romans 12, verse 1, therefore, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. I just want to say, St. Paul wasn't a neuroscientist. All right, so I'm not imagining Paul's thinking about neuroplasticity. But I want to suggest that this wouldn't shock him. Renewing of our mind is not a metaphor. It is for real. It is about God doing things in your body that is real and new and different and can be established. It's not just a passing thing. It's not just a thing where, gosh, I heard that great sermon, and I want that to transform my life, and I go home and behave like I always have. Because transformation, neuroplastic change, requires practice. And it requires practice in community. We don't have time to talk about all that this morning, but these were some of the things that Steve was discovering about his life. And recognizing that if he wanted to make changes, he knew that he couldn't go back and rewrite history. He wasn't going to get his son back. But what does it mean for him to re-understand the notion of his own life? So I want to talk about three things real quickly, and then we're going to wrap up for some Q&A. Attention, memory, and attachment. Besides emotion, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about the brain and its activity is the question of attention. We like to say that if emotion is the fuel in the engine, then attention is the ignition key that turns it on. There's nothing that we do that does not require a shift in our attention. I mean moment to moment to moment, right now. Some of you are thinking, like, when's this guy going to be done? Some of you are thinking, I really have to go to the bathroom. Some of you are thinking, what am I going to make for lunch? Right, our attention is someplace else, but it moves, and we move back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and attention then becomes the thing that draws and pulls everything else along with it. Here's a question. How well are you paying attention to what you're paying attention to? How well are you paying attention to what you're paying attention to? Attention is everything. And so to what degree that is active in our life will be the degree to which we then practice what we pay attention to, and that is what we become. And there's an interesting thing about attention in that I will be drawn to things that tend to be dangerous. My attention will tend to be drawn to things that are dangerous. And even if that danger is not just some guy with a handgun, if the danger happens to be a feeling that I have that is uncomfortable, right? How many of us grew up in a house where anytime somebody gets angry, dangerous things happen? So we learn pretty quickly to pay attention to anger so that we can avoid it, for instance. Which is interesting because it would appear that we serve a God who's really quite comfortable with anger and who wants to invite us to tell him about how we're angry. But we don't want to talk about that because we've paid enough attention to see to it that that's not a good thing, and so we're going to draw our attention someplace else. This happens in marriage all the time, right? Because we bring our families of origin with us to everything we do. We bring it to school, we bring it to work, we bring it to our marriages. And we're sorry that that happens, right? But what that means is that often we're having a conversation with our spouse and standing right behind them is our mother. I don't mean like for real. but you know what I mean. Like they say something and you feel the same thing that you felt when you were 10. And you want to do the same thing that you wanted to do when you were 10. Which is either run away or you want to hit somebody. But we don't pay attention to the fact that these things are happening until somebody else starts to ask us questions about what is really going on, what is really true about the nature of our story. We pay attention to things. What we pay attention to, we remember. Memory. Without going into a lot of detail, we would say that there's nothing that we do either without having to remember. We remember mostly not just to pay attention to the past. We remember in order to anticipate the future. Right? Just think of squirrels. They remember where the acorns are so they can find them in the wintertime, right? When you stand up here and leave, you're going to have to remember how to walk out of the room. That's a kind of memory. It's called implicit memory. We have all kinds of implicit memories that get activated. That happens in conversations with people as well, right? When somebody says something and you feel something and you react to that same thing and it's a reaction that feels very familiar to you that began when you were a kid, but you don't really recognize that anything other than, well, I'm just angry at my boss. That's all this is about. Memory is an interesting thing in the biblical narrative as well, right? How many times does Moses say in Deuteronomy 8, remember, 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 because if you don't, you will forget? My wife says this to me all the time. The challenge is that for most of us, memory has become an automatic thing. And we remember in ways that actually create increasingly more and more trouble for us. We just don't know that that's happening. We think it's just my boss. We think it's just my spouse. We think it's just my kid. Now, one thing that Steve was not expecting in the course of our conversation was for us to begin to explore some things in his life in which, as he remembered them, they activated large portions of things that he felt that were really sad and that were really disappointed and over which he was grieved. relationships with his parents, with friends, and so forth that had gone by the wayside because of all this stuff that had happened about faith. And the more we talked, and the more connected he got to things that he had been conveniently avoiding for probably 40 years, the more he became curious about how is it possible for me to have been in a profession which we bank on knowing as much as we can possibly know, and there's all this stuff that I have not known? That's a hard question. We talked an awful lot about attachment. And with attachment, we've come to the place where we really explore the way in which all these things about the mind come to be integrated in a little person by virtue of that little person's interaction with their primary caregivers. Recognizing that the way that we interact with children doesn't just teach them things, it shapes their brain. And these children then learn in this relationship what it then means to relate to others as they are going forward. And the really good news is this. You see, for Steve, his attachment with his parents had been pretty limited. Didn't mean that he didn't feel connected at all. It just meant that there were certain important ways that attachment should have happened that didn't take place. And as such, certain parts of his mind didn't get any attention, like fields of emotion. And consequently, there were large chunks of human relationships that just went by him that he didn't notice, like the one with his son. Needless to say, Steve, with all of his intellectual horsepower, was overwhelmed with guilt that somehow he had not seen enough, he had not known enough, he had not been enough to stop the tragedy. You get that? And how does anyone survive that kind of guilt without a God? Let me just say this, that Steve is still in process, still talking, still working through things. But for the first time in 40 years, he's open to the possibility that there is a God and that that God might in fact love him. Because who else would do what Jesus did? You see, the whole issue of redemption, the whole issue of our minds being renewed, the whole issue of integration in the brain depends upon someone being willing to come to find us in all of our brokenness and stay with us when we reveal all the ugliness that we are about to reveal. Wow. Coming to, like, I've never had organ music help me wrap up my talk. Like, right on, Susan, that's amazing. That's just amazing. But we get it. You see, this whole idea about what our brains are doing and what it means for having our minds renewed are all housed in what Jesus is about. Because in our brokenness, we need another brain to help us. And we need another brain that is able to go as far and farther than we can imagine anybody coming to find us. And this is what Emmanuel is all about. There's no stone that he will leave unturned, because he's not coming just for part of us. He's coming for everything. And the degree to which we are willing to live in that world means that we don't just change how we feel about ourselves. It means everything about what we do, parenting, engineering, architecture, art, music, pastoring, you name it, everything will be different as our minds are renewed and as we allow God to use the data that he now has at his disposal to help us become more familiar with that process. In the 17th chapter of Acts, there's a conversation that takes place in which there's concern about whether or not God is going to be okay in which the apostles say, God does not leave himself without a witness. And in our day, and in our time, in our exile, my sense is that this is one more way, this interpersonal neurobiology is one more way that God is using his created world to bear witness to the work that he has done in his son, Jesus, in transforming not just our personal lives, but the world around us that we occupy by extension. So I think I'm going to wrap up with that. And thank you for your attentiveness. I think we have microphones. I think if people have questions. Am I going to name people who do? This gentleman has a question, I think. Yeah. And let's do this. Since it's 10:17, you know how these things work, right? Q&A. The first paragraph of the question is not a question, right? So let's try to limit it to like real questions.
Kurt, are you aware of any very close interaction of paranoid schizophrenia in people who have very tight families, have all their lives been battling against the culture?
Well, let me just say that that's a question we could probably talk for several hours about.
Yes.
But let me just say this, just a comment about this. Speaking about culture, one of the questions that I'm often asked would be about either if a person has schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or something that is really neuropsychiatrically overwhelming. And we want to say, well, what is God doing about that in that person, you know, in Bill's life, right? We're going to name Bill as the problem. And I want to suggest that one of the things that this is teaching us, that this interpersonal neurobiology is teaching us, is not just about the nature of how we act as individuals. Because the question that I would have, like if Bill has schizophrenia, if Bill has bipolar disorder, who has more trouble? Bill or the people who have to live with Bill? It's a real question. Like, Bill sometimes doesn't seem to have any trouble at all. I mean, he has trouble. But not trouble that bothers him. Like, Bill bothers me. I'm the one who has trouble with Bill. And so part of the question that this does, especially this whole idea that the mind is embodied and relational, speaks to the question of healing communities. In the forthcoming book that I have on shame, we're going to deal a lot about, like, what does it mean for us to be a healing community? Because if you look at John 9, it's all about, it's about a man born blind, right? It's about a man born blind. But it's mostly about the community and what the community does to him in his blindness. And so when it comes to these kinds of questions, like there will always be questions of what does any person's experience that we might say is psychiatrically impaired say about the immediate culture around them and how that culture is responding to them. We want a religion of convenience. And it would appear that the gospel has come to tell us that like, we've got one that's anything but that. Yeah.
Dr. Curtis, not everyone has the time or the money to go to a psychiatrist for therapy.
Unfortunately.
So for the common Joe, what tools and resources are available to him to discover what he does not know about himself?
Right. Great question. So one of the things that we emphasize in the last couple of chapters of this book has to do with this question of what we do in communities. We look at what Jesus does with Peter in John 21, because the issue is, like, look, this kind of information is helpful to inform people of things, but the real question gets back to one of those first questions that I asked at the top of our time. By whom are you well known? Who are the people that are in your life that know you so well such that if somebody were to take a poll, they could tell you everything about them? And so one of the things that I encourage is being engaged in active, intimate communities of four or five people, confessional communities. We talk about that quite a bit in this book. That this is not something in which we require necessarily. You don't have to have, like, a PhD in psychology in order to pull this off. It's really more about the question of what is the community in which I'm living. And, of course, we may not have expertise, and we say, well, we don't have the time. It's not true that we don't have the time. We make time for things that are important. And let me just say, this is not the pot calling the kettle black. Like I'm saying, like, it's really hard to do. At the beginning, like, it's hard to follow Jesus. Part of why it's hard to follow Jesus in our culture is that we've got 100 things to do in the space to do 10. Right? And we live in, like, literally, we live in an environment where developing community, the nature of what we're talking about, requires the kind of time that many of us don't feel like we can afford to give. Would that be fair to say? It's hard to do. This is no like Pollyanna, like, oh, just these three simple steps and you'll be fine. No, it's really hard to do. And it's also the case that if we were to do this, it would radically change the communities in which we live. So here's an example. So I was in Tennessee a few years ago, and one of the exercises that I give is this. I say, look, pick three other people, and I want you to try this experiment for 6 weeks. It's a confessional exercise. And here's the deal. In those people, you're going to meet once a week for 6 weeks, and in that time, you're going to confess to one another everything you've done that you would consider to be against God's law. Sin. Like, make sure that you've got lots of paper to keep track of your list. Right? And we're going to do that. And here's the other thing. Like, you want to pick people that you trust. You want to pick people that are safe. All right? You're not just picking somebody off the street. You want to pick people that are safe. But you especially want to confess any thought that you've had about them. You heard that, right? So we talk about this in the book, and then I list like all the reasons why everybody's going to think this is a really bad idea. And you'll think it's a bad idea. And I say, like, you won't want to do this. For all the reasons listed, you're not going to want to do this. I'm in Tennessee. I give this, I offer this. Like, 3 months later, I get an email from a group of women who'd actually, like, tried this. I'm like, oh my gosh, somebody took me seriously. I have to be careful about where I say these things. And they said, you won't believe what's happening. And so they talked about the transformative effect that was taking place in their own life. Because imagine this for a moment. Imagine, I know, it's hard to imagine, but imagine what it would be like if you had a group of people who knew everything there was to know about you that you were ashamed of. And they were still like, man, I can't wait to see you next week. Imagine what this would be like. To be so confessed, so known, so transparently known, that you can count on when next week rolls around and you come to say the things about yourself that you don't like to say, and they hear that, they say, you're forgiven. We're so glad that you're ours. Imagine that. And imagine the kind of experience it would start to create in your mind as you anticipate things. Imagine how much more energy you would have at your disposal because you're now not using that energy to contain all the stuff that you're ashamed of that you're not telling anybody. You with me? Because what you begin to find is that, like, life just becomes much less anxiety-provoking the more I'm engaged in this kind of a transparent relationship. They said, but here's the part that really surprised us, these women. They said, we started to get comments from people. They worked in different places. We started to get comments from people in our workplaces. People who were like, what's happening with you? Like, you're so much more carefree. You're so much, like, you're taking risks with things. You're trying to, like, you're, like, you just seem so much more at ease with your own skin. What's going on? And they said, we were sure that part of this had to do with what it meant to live as if this really is the body of Jesus. That's a long-winded answer to your question, but suffice to say, yeah.
And that's going to have to be the end. We're going to have to continue this at some other time.
Okay.
Would you join me in thanking Kurt for being with us? A very brief prayer as we close. Gracious God, we thank you for the gift of community, the body of Christ, and we pray that you would show us how we can be part of that and how we can be known. And would you give us a vision for that, to be all that we can as your creatures in your image, in community, being known by you and your people. We pray this in Christ's name, who knows us. Amen.